This episode of Film Feeder is brought to you by Entertainment Earth, the premier online shopping destination for all things pop culture. Stick around to hear more about the fantastic offer I have to help you begin building your collection today. Hello, and welcome back to the Film Feeder podcast. I'm your film chef extraordinaire, Jack Martin, here to serve up some tasty treats from the world of cinema each and every month. And the treat I've got in store for you this episode is a very new one. So new, in fact, that as of recording this episode, it hasn't even come out yet. But it's one that I just haven't been able to get out of my head since seeing it for the first time, I think like 9 months ago now, which is insane.
Yeah, we saw it back in September.
We did, yeah.
Crazy like that. It's been a long time.
And once you see it for yourself, you'll know why. We are, of course, talking about Hitman, which is the latest film from acclaimed filmmaker Richard Linklater. And it stars Glenn Powell, Adria Arjona, Austin Emilio, Retta, and Sanjay Rao, among many others. And it's due out on Netflix from June the 7th with a limited theatrical window from May 24th. And the voice you heard just now is one I'm especially excited for, because joining me in for this in-depth look at the film is someone that I've been quite a big fan of for a lot of years. Is one of the many reasons why I got into like reviewing films in the first place, and I'm now delighted to call him a personal friend. So it's Mr. Film Brain himself, Matthew Burke. Hi, Matthew.
Oh, stop it, I'm blushing.
Well, thank you very much for joining me. And how are you doing this fine day?
I'm doing okay. I'm doing all right. I'm just looking forward to talking about this because this was one of my big favourites at the London Film Festival, and we kind of met up at this movie, actually. I think this is the first time we bumped into each other in person.
We did, so, yeah.
Oh, it has that significance as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's this is one, I'd seen a couple of things earlier on that week, because Hitman, it was only showing during like the press screenings, like in the couple of weeks leading up to the film festival. And Hitman was like the first one at like 8 or 9 or something ridiculous on the Wednesday. And yeah, I saw that you were there, and I thought, oh, wow, that's someone I actually recognize among a whole other bunch of journalists. And I just thought, you know what, off chance, you know, worst case scenario, I'll probably choke, but yeah, I went up, said hi, and luckily you were very accommodating. We got to talking, and no, it's really cool. I'm a bit starstruck myself, honestly, because obviously some people may know you for your days on a channel that shall not be named, and doing all sorts of projector episodes on current releases, and also a very good series called Bad Movie Beatdown, where you talk in depth about why a film doesn't exactly work, which I've always really admired. You always have a very in-depth look as to what makes a film work or not work. So I thought, what better person to talk about this film than you, because obviously we've got a lot to talk about, yeah, why people should see it.
Yeah, it is a really entertaining movie, and that was the thing that I really took out of it when I came out of the film, was just how much of a big crowd pleaser it was. So it was with mixed feelings, I think, that many people discovered that it was picked up by Netflix, but we'll get into that a bit later.
Yeah, no, there's so much to talk about. I mean, first of all, right off the bat, I mean, this movie is fantastic. I said in your podcast, because we talked about it on there a little bit, this was honestly my favorite film that I saw out of the whole festival. And there are a lot of good ones, you know, Poor Things, The Holdovers, but this was the one I think I only gave like one of the only ones I gave like 5 full stars to. And this is a film that I mean, I love this kind of film anyway. This kind of like it goes through all sorts of different genres and picks up different tones and everything. And it all comes together very well by a filmmaker who's really at the top of his game here. And of course, it's a fantastic leading vehicle for its stars. And yeah, that's just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to this film. It's also very smart with its themes and how it presents them, and just how it just uses all of that to create such a, like you said, a crowd-pleasing experience. And so I think best place to start off with, because again, this is going, a lot of people are probably going to be hearing or watching this before the film is even out. So we're going to do our best to not give as many spoilers, because obviously we want you to experience
Yeah.
them for yourselves.
This is very much a movie that you need to kind of go in as cold into as you'd probably hope, I think, because I think if you came into this knowing where it goes overall, I think it might diminish some of the surprise. I think a lot of the way that it plays on the first viewing depends on the plot mechanics and not really knowing where it's going.
I agree, but I mean, we can reveal some basic plot details. Yeah, I
Yes,
like
I
that.
think
Like,
we
just some,
can.
but so the film is, it takes place in New Orleans, Louisiana, and Glenn Powell, who many of you may know for films like Top Gun Maverick and Anyone But You, he stars as a guy named Gary Johnson, and he's, you know, very kind of like mild, I wouldn't say mild-mannered, he's a very ordinary guy. Like,
Yes.
he's a philosophy professor at a local college. He lives a very a quiet life. He lives alone in an apartment. He's divorced but still on good terms with his ex-wife, and he's even got a couple of cats named Id and Ego. That'll become important later on. But in his spare time, you know, he does some work for the local police department, like some tech work, and he obviously helps out with some sting operations as well. But then it all kicks off when one cop, who's played by Austin Emilio, he's kind of like suspended from the force.
Yeah, Jasper.
Yeah, Jasper, that's his name. Yes, Austin Emilio. And yeah, so he's usually the guy like who goes in to like coerce people into accepting fake offers for hitmen and then promptly arrest them. And obviously, Jasper can't do it anymore. So at the last minute, Gary is asked to just go in and just kind of fill in that role. And so he goes in. It's like a little cafe bar that he goes into, and he meets with the guy, and something extraordinary happens. Like, immediately, Gary, it just completely transforms right in front of him. He just becomes this fake hitman. Like, his background details, even details that weren't even in the original brief, like, he just goes into it straight like that. And he ends up, not only does he end up impressing the guy that he's supposed to get, but he's also he also gets him to accept the money, and he's promptly arrested, and it just awakens something in him. It really it kind of like kicks off this kind of oh wow, this is something I'm genuinely good at. This is like a thing that I can, you know, do just to kind of feel alive. It's like it kind of becomes a bit like a drug to him in a way, like because he starts, you know, adopting various other guises, you know, and just to kind of like custom make himself as to what the supposed client wants to see out of a hitman. And it all works out pretty well. You know, he takes on all these characters and everything, but then something else happens. He meets with one client who's Madison, I believe her name is, the character played by Adria Arjona, and they click. They immediately hit it off, no pun intended. And they and he, 'cause she originally comes to him because she wants him to take out her abusive husband. And you know, at first, you know, it seems like he's going to go through with it, but then during the course of their conversation, you know, they really hit it off, like I said. And then he just, you know, actually tells him, actually, you don't need me to bump someone off. You know, you take that money you were going to give me, and you know, put it to something better, and then something like that. Then that kicks off this whirlwind romance that they go on. And I think that's a good place to stop in terms of like the actual plot, because where it goes from there is a very I mean it's not by the book by any means. It plays with certain conventions, but it does them in a way that's genuinely surprising. Like I mean how hopefully that was a good enough roundup. I don't know if I missed any bits out, but is there anything you want to add?
No, I think that's a pretty comprehensive overview of at least, like I would say, the first act of the movie. It's worth noting that the film is actually based on an article by Skip Hollandsworth, who Linklater previously worked with on Bernie. He wrote an article that was the source for that movie. I think this is based on a 2001 article. So Gary Johnston, is that his name, if I remember
I
correctly?
think it's Gary Johnson, yeah.
Yeah, Gary Johnson. Sorry, Gary Johnson is a it was a real person. He really did work with the New Orleans Police Department, and so a lot of the first act of the movie, as I understand it, is actually based on a lot of his experiences, and that's probably the most closely related to fact. And then after that point, it kind of jumps off into the realms of fiction, and the movie openly acknowledges this. I think at the end, it talks about the real life counterpart and mentions, he's just a really chill guy. And apparently, Linklater was in touch with him for quite a long time during the film's production process. He'd been wanting to make this for decades, and then during the pandemic, he kind of came back to it. Sadly, Johnson passed just as they were starting production on the movie, unfortunately. So I wonder what he would make of where the direction of the story goes overall. But certainly they go, oh, it's based on a true story, but there's a lot of stuff that we made up here.
It does that kind of thing you kind of see in like very humorous takes on real life where it like begins with a little text that's like, this is based on a true story, dot 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 mostly. And it's kind of this as well, but it's really not obnoxious about it at all. In fact, I think it's only really reserved for like the last final title card and stuff. But so that's the film just in a nutshell. And there's a lot to take away from it. I mean, first of all, I think there's the very basic core concepts here of identity. I think that there's so much to say about, beyond the fact that, Gary Johnson is adopting all of these different personas. Like, one of them is like a very well-dressed businessman, and another's this really dark-haired, like Russian guy, and another one, which had perhaps earned one of the biggest laughs, was this very strange, orange-bobbed Tilda Swinton-like character who speaks in British accent. It's like if Tilda Swinton somehow played Bonnie and Clyde, Like it got a huge laugh from the audience, and we will talk about the audience experience more in a bit, but. Yeah, it juggles themes of identity, and it's just like it knowledge it, the character's knowledge and experience of philosophy surrounding the ego is it's deeply infectious, like to a point where his cats, like I said, are even named Id and Ego, and the way that he taps into all of these different personas with unspeakable ease, perhaps it's possible that he's trying to compensate for his underwhelming true self. Like, because like I mentioned, he's a very basic guy, like rimless spectacles and kind of like combed back longish hair
And the jorts. The
and
jorts are a
jorts.
very distinctive element early on in the movie that, like, you can't go in walking as a hitman wearing jorts. No one's going to believe
Oh, I can't forget the
that.
jorts.
Can't forget the jorts.
But obviously, nothing like all these various people that he becomes later on the film, and nowhere is that more opposite than this Ron persona, which is the persona he uses when he meets Madison, and because Ron is a creation that is seems to be made up of Gary's personal like what he wants to be, like it's made clear a number of points in the movie that he is that there's a lot that he's lacking in life. Like there's a conversation he has with his ex-wife. I mean that they're still friendly, but she goes on a bit of a diatribe about how he wasn't exactly great in bed, like he wasn't a particularly great lover, and he applies that to Ron because when he's with Madison, like. it's like something out of like a Skinamax film, honestly. Like it's very, very, very erotic. He's a very passionate lover, and it's a kind of like putting one's identity aside and then adopting so many others, and it leads to all sorts of crazy stuff. I mean, is there anything that you picked up on in terms of that particular thing?
Yeah, in terms of the film's identity, like he tailors his various hitmen persona to what the expectations of the various people that he's trying to essentially get confessions out of. He's trying to play towards their expectations. I think one of the funniest recurring gags in the movie is the fact that the movie is aware that the concept of a hitman, as we understand them in like kind of films and things, is almost sort of ridiculous, you know, looking in a catalogue, oh, I can find a hitman there. And so it kind of plays with that idea of, okay, how can we push this into the realms of the absurd? And I think that Powell is having so much fun kind of adopting all of these various different accents and personas and kind of playing around with the comic potential of it. I think the movie has fun with the idea of just the fact that a hitman in general is absolutely preposterous as a concept in general, but everyone falls for it because they've seen it in the movies. And that's the fun part of it. But as you said, he seems like quite a meek guy at the start of it. He's someone that you probably wouldn't look twice at. He just comes across as very average, but he knows how to reinvent himself. And over the course of the movie, he's reinventing himself constantly. And I think in terms of identity, that's something that we all do to a certain degree. We all construct our own self-images, our own understandings based on how we perceive ourselves, how we believe that others perceive us. And so I think that the movie plays around a lot with that particular idea. And I feel like, as you said, he becomes different people in the company of different characters. He has to constantly reconfigure himself, and this works out great later in the movie because that adds a degree of tension, because he's having to juggle all of these different identities depending on who he's interacting with at any given moment. But as you said, you do get a definite difference between Gary and Ron, and over the course of the movie, those two identities do start to blur, and you do start to see where Gary is taking something that he's learnt as Ron and applying that to himself. And I think that if there is something to be said about the movie, it is about the idea of not just identity, but also in terms of the psychology of the main character, of maybe discovering that, oh, this maybe isn't actually true about myself. I can change that. I can reconfigure who I am. I can be this completely different person and have the confidence that I felt like I couldn't have before. You know, he completely changes the way he looks, completely changes the way he dresses, he drops the glasses in the Ron persona. And so that kind of mixing of the two identities also provides a lot of fun for Powell to play as a performer.
But one of the interesting things about that is, that because this isn't a film where he's like getting so lost in these like various amplified identities that he doesn't remember exactly who he is from the start. Like as soon as like the trouble is a brewing, without giving any spoilers, like he pretty much immediately drops characters. I'm just like, nope, I'm out. Like it's an interesting kind of way, because I mean you see a lot of films where like people who are quite meek at the beginning, they adopt new guises and kind of start to actually become that person, and they lose a sense of who they are, and that usual kind of formula. But this one is interesting because it shows that he's self-aware to a point. Like he's very he knows when to play it up as Ron or the Russian bad guy or whatnot, but he still remembers that he's just plain old Gary. And I admire that, it's not a film that's really about just kind of like deciding like what is it that I exactly am in this world. He knows, but he's just like, how can I apply that to just kind of like better not just my life, but potentially someone else's? And this is where obviously the crux of this central romance between him and Madison, which gets off to a great start, and then experiences some turbulence along the way. And I'm not just
Yeah.
saying that because Ahonna at one point actually dresses up as the pilot for a bit of like role play in a very steamy sequence, one of many. But yeah, I think there's a lot to say as well. You know, there's something about projecting masculinity onto all these sorts of
Yes.
things. Because Gary Johnson, he in the film anyway, he's just fine guy, nothing too extraordinary. But then Ron is like again, I feel like I'm repeating myself, but Ron is like polar opposite. It's like he is just like suave, cool. He can just pull a gun on a person without even flinching. And it creates this kind of level of deception that just kind of like it doesn't exactly fool himself because again he knows who he is up to a point, but then as it starts to become dangerous, he figures out, oh, what should I do in this situation? And then it kind of snowballs from there. But I think it's a very well crafted script, which we have to mention. Glenn Powell also co-wrote with Linklater, which isn't uncommon. Richard Linklater's written films with the actors before, like the Before trilogy. He wrote those with Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy. But you definitely get the sense of both writers' personalities in this. From Linklater's kind of like cool, laid back, fun loving guy to Glenn Powell, who just kind of like has a real he has a sense of charm and charisma about him, and that really comes through in here. And I think, yeah, on that topic, I think it's very clear that this is a true movie star vehicle for Glenn Powell, who's
Oh, it
been in.
absolutely is.
He's been in so much stuff over the years. Like, I think one of the first things I think I ever saw him in was, of all things, Expendables 3.
That was one of the things I was thinking of when I came out straight. It's like, oh wait, he was in that, wasn't
Yeah,
he?
there's so much else I forgot about that film. I'm surprised I remember that. But I mean, you know what? He had enough willpower to say no to Expendables, so I commend him on that. But yeah, he's been someone who's honestly a lot of the films I've seen him in, from Hidden Figures to even Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society, like he's always had.
I forgot he was in that.
Well, I didn't. A funny story. I actually met Glenn Powell at they did a Q&A screening for that film, Guernsey Literary and Potato
Oh,
Peel
no
Pie
kidding.
Society, and they did it at the Curzon Mayfair in London. And yeah, it was quite a good panel. Like Mike Newell, the director, was there, and Lily James as well, and Glenn Powell, who obviously wasn't as big then as he is now, but he was very, very charming on the panel. Like he referred to Lily James as Cinderella at one point, just to like laugh. I even got to say hi to him afterwards. I got a picture with him, which I'll put right here. So
Pretty
that was
cool.
pretty cool. No,
He's
very
worked with
charming.
Linklater quite a bit in the past, as I understand it. He worked with him on Everybody Gets Some previously. He way back in his like child star days, he was in Fast Food Nation as a teen, which I didn't realize. It's been so long since I saw that movie. But yeah, he recently popped up in the Apollo movie that he did for Netflix as well. So they've kind of been in each other's orbit, to excuse the pun, given that I just mentioned
Yeah,
the Apollo. But
no,
yeah,
you.
this is definitely a case where I think the movie plays to the strengths of its star. I think that Glenn Powell's been someone that has been kind of circling some for quite some time now. You've mentioned how he's been sort of in these big projects, but he hasn't really come, as a like big star vehicle yet. But I think recently we've had, both this and also Anyone But You. And Anyone But You I saw after this movie, so that was interesting, because for most people it will be the reverse. And I think what is in common between both of these movies is that Powell is just such a likable presence on screen. You really get won over by his performances. I think in terms of his, sort of masculinity and his identity, I feel like as a screen persona, Powell definitely has this very, just very, I he's handsome, very conventionally handsome. But there is this kind of classical movie star edge about him. There's a real charm to his performance. And I think that's true in both of these movies, which are technically both rom-coms in their own way. They're both, you know, kind of, you know, you've got a male lead and a romantic female lead, you know, kind of playing off of each other. And I think in both movies, he has terrific chemistry with his co-stars. He played beautifully off Sidney Sweeney. I think if you see Anyone But You, you can tell that he doesn't just have great romantic chemistry, he has great comic chemistry, and that's important. And Hitman is an even further example of that, because Powell has to do so much comic heavy lifting, but then you put him in the scenes with Ahona. Apologies for getting that wrong in my own podcast. Oops.
I'm sure they'll forgive you.
Yeah. Anyway, so you put him in the scenes with Ahona, and they play off of each other beautifully, because they have not just the kind of romantic fire going on in their scenes, but also their scenes are just funny. Like, they genuinely do have, like, great on-screen passion together. And I feel like Powell in particular, I think what he has as a sort of masculinity is actually a great deal of warmth and compassion. That's what he very much generates on screen, and that is very sexy. That is very attractive. A lot of men seem to think, you know, women are attracted to, like, the strength and everything, and that's actually not really that. I mean, you get some of that in Ron, but it's the Gary side of his persona that I think that she really becomes attracted to underneath all of that.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting parallel, because, again, Ron is someone that by all accounts should be like the hunk that, you know, I want to be with at the end. But like you said, the more that she gets to know the Gary side, you know, that the more she realizes there is actually like a more compassionate person in there, someone who's definitely not the person that I met initially, but you know, that there is someone who is there, who is genuinely sweet and does kind of genuinely care. Like one of the climactic scenes is, you know, him just being all about, you know, trying to get someone out of a jam. And it's, I mean, we'll talk about it again later on, but it's one of the most euphoric moments in the movie, because I mean, by all accounts, you know, this is a couple that, you know, has gotten together under false pretenses when you think about it. But the more that, as it goes along, you know, you get the sense that they're opening up to each other in ways that neither of them would have expected. Like that they are revealing things about themselves that don't fit the quote unquote masculine model. Like, I mean, because like you said, Glenn Powell is a very handsome guy. Like he's got a great face. He's got a really good smile as well. Like I've always noticed that about him. Like the way that he smiles is very, like, very charming, even when he's like smarmy as hell, like in Top Gun Maverick.
It's very sincere and very open, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, this is a guy like, oh yeah, I believe it when he's smiling like that. But I think here it's interesting, because I mean, all these personas in their way, they are very different types of masculine energy. Like one of the ones that I mentioned, forgot to mention anyway, was this kind of like redneck persona where he's like dressed head to toe in like a bandana and a kind of like long hair, like real kind of like Floridian guy, you know, like, and is kind of like adopting these kind of like redneck macho kind of things. He's like very bro-y with his potential client, and you can tell like there's a slight you can tell slightly underneath that he's not exactly comfortable with adopting all these very overtly masculine and quite aggressive personalities, because obviously that's not who he is in real life. But he's very he's very careful about it. Like he really literally custom creates all these characters to fit what the person wants, because like you said, they make it very clear that the idea of a hitman is a complete fantasy. Like it is something that really does exist only in the movies, and it really, like you said, it plays around with it so much, and it kind of like not to where like the lines between reality and fantasy necessarily blur, but like it's to a point where people are so willing to believe it because they've seen it in like so many films and shows that, you know, yeah, the prospect of actually being there right in front of him is just a mind-blowing experience. And he really tailors that so well to that kind of performance, as it were. But I think there's a lot to, yeah, there's so much that Powell does, you know, because you mentioned all these personas, like he's having fun with it. You know, one of the things I was really getting off was how much Peter Sellers did that kind of like same thing. You know, like when he's like all these different people in something like Doctor Strangelove, for instance, one of his big trademarks was just, you know, really losing himself into all these characters. And to an extent, Powell does that here too. But I mean, they're obviously very far-fetched and very extreme personas. Like, again,
They're all kind of archetypes, aren't they? They're all
they
kind of,
are.
the sort of almost kind of like cliches almost, but kind of exaggerated to a sense of just kind of making fun of them in a certain way.
It's like someone, it's like they combined all the tropes of Hitman and just put them into one movie. And it's kind of like a bit of a celebration of that trope, but also kind of like an acknowledgement that, yeah, this is kind of ridiculous.
It kind of plays around with the conventions while also deconstructing them. And I think the movie as a whole is kind of doing that entire thing, because it, as you're watching the movie, you think, oh, it's going this way, and then it kind of swings into another way, and then it swings somewhere else. It's changing identity constantly itself in terms of its genre and its identity, because it kind of starts out as a bit of like a sort of like a crime thriller, but with a darkly comic edge, and it keeps that darkly comic edge, but then it becomes a romance, and then that thriller angle really starts to come to the fore later on in the movie. And
Yeah,
you've got these kind of noirish elements as well.
no, I think there's also it also goes into like how the film is shot as well, because this is one of the rare few films that takes place outside of Texas, which is one of Linklater's like trademarks, you know, going all the way back to like Dazed and Confused, and like you said, Bernie, and Everybody Wants Some. A lot of them take place around that kind of like Houston, Austin kind of vibe. But whereas this one, no, it's all in Louisiana. And it takes it, the cinematography, I feel, really takes advantage of like this different kind of setting. Like there's lots of like little there's lots of bright colors and like the neon signs that they visit, like various restaurants and bars. And it's a very colorful film, actually, when you think about it, because you know, there's stuff to really admire, like, even when they're in the nightclub. You know, there's all sorts of like yellows and greens and all that sort of stuff. And you don't really find a lot of that and a lot of Linklater's previous films. I mean, there are colorful films in their own right, but I mean, there's something about the way that the cinematography creates the city of New Orleans, or just Louisiana in general, as this kind of haven for just stuff that only happens in the movies. Like it's a very movie kind of color. Like in actuality, a lot of this lighting and stuff, it's not practical in real life, but in the movie makes it feel like this kind of we've stepped into a fantasy, like with all these other fantastical creatures who just happen to be people for hire. And I think that there's a lot to say about just how Linklater paces the film as a whole, because this is a film that juggles so many genres and tones and stuff. I mean, at one point it turns into a bit of a courtroom drama, and on top of all the crime thriller and all that sort of stuff. But I think there's so much else to say about, you know, how Linklater, you know, he paces it so well, in the sense that all of this stuff is happening and it never loses sight of itself. Like it really, it flows quite beautifully, as a matter of fact.
It's very delicate with regards to its pacing, because it starts out maybe a little bit slowly, but it starts to very quickly pick up momentum. But I like the way that Linklater's direction is quite understated, because I remember saying to you when I came out of that screening that I could imagine a version of this movie where they really played up the broadly comic elements of it, like they really leaned into the disguise elements. I could see a version of the movie like that, and Linklater kind of goes against that and instead actually goes for quite an understated approach to the material, which I think suits it much better, because it allows that kind of those kind of absurd moments to stand out as being such, but also allows him to more carefully navigate between the various tones that he has to kind of blend between the various guises of the movie.
If you're listening to this, then congratulations, you're now halfway through the episode. But before we continue, I want to give a special shout out to this episode's sponsor, Entertainment Earth. If, like me, you're absolutely obsessed with all things pop culture and want to own some fun collectibles and memorabilia, then Entertainment Earth has you covered with thousands of action figures, Funko Pop figurines, prop replicas, and plenty more in stock from all sorts of popular franchises like Star Wars, Transformers, James Bond, and beyond. Being something of a Marvel fan myself, I'm particularly excited about the upcoming release of Deadpool and Wolverine. So imagine my delight when I found plenty of Deadpool toys and accessories to choose from at a reasonable price, including some newly released Funko Pops featuring both Deadpool and Wolverine in their costumes from the forthcoming movie. And I've linked to those particular items in the description if you're eager to complete your collection. As you can already tell, Entertainment Earth is an absolute treasure trove of pop culture goodness that ships all over the world, with a groundbreaking mint condition guarantee that ensures you're always receiving the best quality item, as well as a 90-day return policy that's completely hassle-free. What's more, if you go to ee.toys/filmfeeder, FilmFeeder, link in the description, you can get 10% off all in-stock items, as well as free shipping, US only, for all orders over $79 until June 30th. So there's no better time to begin your risk-free shopping spree than right now. Once more, that's ee.toys/filmfeeder, FilmFeeder, for 10% off all in-stock items. And thanks once again to Entertainment Earth for sponsoring this episode. Speaking of which, let's get back to the show. Yeah, no, I think it's, you're right, Linklater definitely could have, make this an all-out comedy, kind of like something like School of Rock or even Bad News Bears, but he really chose to kind of play also a lot into the sexiness of the film. And I think that there is a very interesting way that it plays with that kind of eroticism in a way that's not gratuitous. It's not overplayed. Like, I mean, you see a lot of people creating a discourse around sex scenes in cinema nowadays, and it's a bit iffy. I mean, some of it makes sense, some of it doesn't, but this is one of the few films I think will not have many people disagreeing on how it uses sex as like a kind of storytelling method. Like obviously it shows the development of the characters, but also, you know, it creates that sense of horniness, I guess, in a sorry word, because this is quite a horny film when you think about it, because I mean the way that, you know, certain love scenes are shot, they're just very erotic in tone, and they're played beautifully by the actors and of course shot very well, but there's something about it that really kind of gets you all hot and bothered, and it's a very strange thing to say about a film about a guy who just pretends to be a hitman. It's kind of like, wow, this is actually quite hot, you know, like it's kind of hot seeing these people together, and it's quite something.
I think it's the ultimate compliment to the actors' performances and their chemistry that genuinely does come across in the movie, because it's such a pivotal part of the film, the entire romance angle between the two characters. It is a major driving force in the film's plot, so if we don't believe in their relationship, then that sinks the entire movie. And the great thing about Hitman is you watch both Ahona and Powell on screen and you completely buy into their relationship. They are great together. The point of comparison that I was thinking of while I was watching the movie was, of course, something like Out of Sight, which had that enormous chemistry between George Clooney and Jennifer Lopez all throughout the entire movie. And that, I mean, it's especially striking because that film doesn't have a overt sex scene in the way that Hitman does. It kind of more is about the kind of foreplay between the characters. Whereas this, I do think that there is an evolution in terms of, you know, his identity both as a lover and also as a person. I think that she brings out different qualities from him. And I do think that that is very, very sexy in its own way. And I'm aware that, you know, film critics talking about, you know, sex scenes in films and, oh, this film is gets you really hot under the collar. It can be a little bit cringe because, you know, I don't really think of myself in that sort of way. But it is genuinely what I felt during the screening. I was like, wow, these two, you know, they're going to burn up the screen. It really is electrifying.
It's insane how well they go together. Like, again, it is just a testament to how well they work off of each other. Like in that first scene where they're meeting in that diner, like they are just kind of like firing on all cylinders. Like it's quite something. And yeah, absolutely, Out of Sight is a great comparison because, I mean, obviously when you think of that movie, you just think of, or it is a very intimate film, and so is this in a way. And this is, it really kind of grasps the fact that, you know, these two have such a connection, and they show it through all these very intimate scenes. You know, they even indulge in a bit of role play, like I said, mentioned the pilot captain scene, which is quite erotic in its own terms. And it's, yeah, I think it's just these two very beautiful people just coming together, and not, like you said, not only being sexy together, but also being genuine together, like being funny. They're quite sweet together until, you know, things take a turn.
I think that's the Linklater edge when you think about it, because a lot of Linklater's movies, you could almost describe them as being kind of like hangout movies. And I think I was watching a Q&A with Richard Linklater, and he was talking about, like, I wanted to make this comic thriller, and then I got them into a dialogue scene that they're just funny together. I'm like, shit, I've made a hangout movie again. But that's the quality that works about it, I think, is that I think what Linklater's great at as a director, when he gets the right material, is that he does create characters that you do genuinely want to see a connection with, that you recognise in yourselves. And I think he has a great quality for kind of creating these chemistry between actors. I mean, you think about the Before trilogy and what's going on between Ethan Hawke and Judy Delpy. I feel like in all of those movies, you know, you get a real sense of the dynamic between the two actors. He replicates that in Hitman. I think he knows how to draw the best out of his performers. And from what I understand, he did quite an extensive rehearsal process for Hitman. There was a moment where someone asked him, "Oh, is it improvised?" And he's like, "Oh yeah, I just let them do what they want." Fuck no. So, like, even the bits that feel natural are very, you know, very predetermined and very much, you know, planned and very strategic. And I think you see that in his movies where they're loose, but they're disciplined. And I think because you have that kind of genuine connection between the characters, it allows for those more kind of sensuous scenes to feel sincere and feel earned in the movie. I think that's the problem that people have with sex scenes sometimes, is they don't feel earned. They don't feel like the relationship between the characters earns that kind of moment between them. I feel like in the case of Hitman, it absolutely does.
Yeah, and I think it goes along with the fact that, you know, 2024 in general so far seems to be a very horny year for film. Like,
Yeah, it really does. It's been ramping up.
We've had Challengers in the last couple of months, Love Lies Bleeding, Drive Away Dolls, and even as far back as Saltburn back in last November. There seems to be a very gradual turn towards films that are, you know, about horny characters.
It's about the connection. It's, I think, is it like, I think that it's a combination of a kind of like a pushback against this criticism that, oh, you know, modern Hollywood films are sterile and sexless. But I think there's also kind of like, we've just come off the back of a pandemic where we've all been separated. I think now, you know, it's all about kind of bodies colliding, as it were. And
Oh,
I
yeah.
think you kind of see that in the projects getting made right now.
Yeah, and I mean, when you look at a film like Challengers, you know, that's a film that is just all about, you know, people being horn dogs for one another. And by the way, if you want to check out Matthew's review for that, it's a great review, by the way. It's up
Oh,
on
thank you.
his YouTube channel. I watched it the other day in preparation for this, and it really just nails how the sexual tension is in that movie. And obviously very different to something like Hitman, where it's much more, I wouldn't say conventional, but it's more like straightforward in terms of as to what Luca Guadagnino does in that film. I think just in general, there seems to be there's an interesting movement, as a movement of horniness, and I like seeing that. And Love Lies Bleeding is another great example of that, where it's just they really kind of hone in on the characters' sexuality, not just like their sexual preferences, but also how they use each other's bodies and how they kind of like are attracted to one another. And I think you definitely get a lot of that sense in Hitman too, because it's just like you said, it's a very sexy film. And I think this movie, out along with it, is kind of bringing that kind of sexiness back to cinemas when, like I said,
They're
we've.
bringing sexy back, Justin Timberlake
Yes.
style.
Justin
But I
Timberlake
know,
would approve.
sexuality in terms of identity is quite important because it is something that makes up a person. I know that, sexuality can make people uncomfortable at times. I can completely understand that, but I feel like, understanding that side of your identity is also important. So it's understandable why it's also focused upon in this movie. I don't feel the sex scenes in this film are gratuitous. They are necessary to the plot and essential to the relationship to the characters. You can't, I don't think you could excise them from the movie without it kind of missing something.
That's very true, and I guess in a sense you kind of feel that in a sense with Anyone But You, because like you said, there is a lot of sexual tension between Glenn Powell and Sydney Sweeney in that film, and more often than not, it definitely shows just in their performances and also the way that they're shot. You know, the one of their love scenes, it's a this very tender moment in the shower, and it's sensual, and again, not quite as gratuitous as it could have been. You know, obviously there's a whole other conversation as to how male and female bodies are portrayed in media, and there's like one lenience towards one more than the other, and there's a whole double standards thing around that. But I felt like, apart from the fact that Glenn Powell does have a pretty magnificent body in and of itself, I mean, it's a very, I mean, obviously that's complemented by how his female co-stars are. It's not pornographic in the way that they're presented. It feels very real. It feels authentic. It feels like, oh wow, I'm actually in a situation with these two people who are loving each other. And like you said, it's weird talking about sex in a film because, I mean, you talk about it so much, people will think, oh, maybe that guy's a perv or whatever.
And also, filming sex scenes is the least sexy thing in the world, as any actor will tell you.
Oh yeah, I mean, I'm sure that so many are, I'm sure so many are thankful for the intimacy coordinators
Oh,
nowadays,
yeah.
but
And we as an audience are very thankful for them as well, because
oh
it provides a
yeah,
bit of reassurance there.
oh yeah, no, it's definitely re revolutionized things. But yeah, I think Hitman, if anyone out there wants a genuinely sexy film, like in the sense of Out of Sight or any of the other many horny films that have come out this year, then I think Hitman is definitely going to be right up your alley. And I know it was for so many people because I actually attended a special Q&A session for Hitman in London, and I've got the
Oh,
results of
nice.
that. Yeah, and I got the results of that right here.
Hello everyone, I'm here at the Picture House Central, and today is a very special day. There's going to be a Hitman Q&A with director Richard Linklater, and I am going to be asking some of the audience members what they thought of the film, why it's a big crowd pleaser that's worth seeing in the cinema as opposed to just Netflix, and yeah, let's do it. Here we go. Now sat for Hitman. It's looking like a pretty good crowd here. Not gonna lie, a lot of people came out tonight, and I'm really happy. Hopefully, get to chat to some of them after.
A round of applause. This is Richard Linklater, everybody.
You've known Glenn for a long time, but did you know? Because I think it might be from doing research for this, didn't know that he has been writing for a long time. It's just, it's that thing where nothing's really been made yet and stuff. And was this something that you knew, and when he reached out to you on
I
that?
Think a surprisingly high number of actors or anyone near the film industry. I mean, just everybody's writing a script. Everybody, you're storytellers. Everybody wants to tell stories. You have, folks. So I didn't really know it, but Glenn said he had written some scripts and things. I think he has some screenwriting partners, whatever. That didn't really matter to me. I was collaborating with him as a future actor in the movie, which comes natural to me anyway, because I do a lot of rehearsal, a lot of workshopping. And I even asked him, we were pretty far along kind of working on an outline or how this story might work. And I said, Glenn, let's just write this together. You save me a step, because we're going to rewrite it anyway in rehearsal. So let's just start now.
Yeah.
I mean, he had so many good ideas. We really make each other laugh. We really push each other. So He was a great collaborator.
As fascinating as Richard Linklater was to listen to, I was much more interested in hearing what the audience themselves had to say about Hitman.
Hello, I'm with someone right now who's just seen Hitman. So, first of all, what's your name?
Charles Holmes.
Charles Holmes, nice to meet you. And just want to ask, what did you think of Hitman?
Great, full of surprises, great cinematography, brilliant acting. It's one of the better movies I've seen in a long time.
Oh, that's really good. And would you say you preferred seeing it in a cinema with an audience rather than at home on Netflix?
That sort of film, I'd be indifferent.
Yeah?
Indifferent, yeah.
Okay. And finally, why do you think people should see Hitman on whatever screen possible?
Full of twists and surprises. And yeah, I like cinematography, as I said. And the acting and the characters were very likable.
And I'm here now with, what is your name?
Tim.
Tim. All right, great to meet you, Tim. What did you think of Hitman?
It was dark and gripping, and it was a really good film. It was brilliantly executed.
I couldn't have said it better myself. And did you enjoy seeing it with an audience in a cinema as opposed to at home on Netflix?
Funny, when it at the beginning when it popped up, it said Netflix presents. You initially think, oh, I could have just waited a few months and seen this. But there's something I think we've lost in the kind of post-COVID world where we don't come to the cinema enough. And there's something all-encompassing about coming to the cinema that it gives you that level of immersion and escapism that you don't get at home. So, yeah, it's great to be in the cinema.
That's great. And one final question. Why do you think people should see Hitman on whatever screen possible?
Because it is a film which twists and turns and delights in a kind of darkly comedic fashion, and it's really well done. It's a properly enjoyable escapist film.
All right, so I'm here now with what's your name?
I'm Mark. Mark Colby. Yeah.
Mark Colby. Nice to meet you. So, what did you think of Hitman?
Absolutely loved it. Absolutely loved it. I thought it was brilliant. I couldn't expand a way to begin to expand on that, right? Totally engrossing, drew me in, yeah. Then wasn't quite sure what direction it was going to go. She was very attractive, which kind of pulled me in, I'm afraid, or not. I was just saying to my friend John that he reminded me a little bit of William Hurt, the lead guy. There was something about him that was a bit like William Hurt. Mm-hmm. But I absolutely loved it. I would thoroughly recommend it to anybody, yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. And did you enjoy seeing it with an audience in a cinema as opposed to at home on Netflix?
Most definitely, absolutely. I did notice when the end came up and I kind of went, oh, okay, it's on Netflix, but I much prefer to come to the cinema to watch a film than to watch it at home on TV, yeah.
And finally, why do you think people should see Hitman on whatever screen possible?
I think it's just an excellent film. I like the director. I think he's done some great work over the years, right? Without sounding too pretentious. But it's kind of got everything, really. It's intelligent, it's engaging, it's thoughtful, at the same time being great fun. Yeah.
All right. So I am here with Veronique. Hi, Veronique. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you.
Okay. So first of all, what are your thoughts on Hitman? Did you like it? Did you dislike it? What?
No, I loved it. I thought it was really entertaining and fun to watch. Very different Richard Linklater. No, that would have been my question to him if he'd done a Q&A, but why he's sort of gone in the comedy direction and after the great dramas that he's written. So that's why I came tonight.
Of course. And did you enjoy seeing it in the cinema with an audience as opposed to watching it at home on Netflix?
Yeah, no, I did. And I, because I'm a member of Picture House Central and I support people going to the cinema, and I think, you know, to have the opportunity to see a great director like that is and that's, you know, you've got to come, really. So come and see the cinema, come and see the film.
And finally, why should people see Hitman on any screen?
Well, I didn't know it was based on a true story. I don't know if that's bad or not, but I didn't know. So, you know, it was such a feel good at the end that I just thought, you know, it intrigued me because I did pick up on all the genres that he was kind of referring to. And there was a lot of reference to other films and Raiders of the Lost Ark, that moment where she kisses him all over them. I thought, you know, those were some really, really nice moments, and I picked up on the references, so I enjoyed that.
So, hello, I'm here with, what's your name?
Corey.
Corey, nice to meet you. So, what did you think of Hitman?
I thought it was amazing. I thought it was really, really amazing. I loved the cinematography. I loved the script. The script was so good. The acting was so good. And you know what? It's great when you watch a film and you can just sit in it. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it was so enjoyable. I didn't want it to end. So when it reached that final act, and when I don't want to spoil the film, but when it reached that final act, I wanted to keep watching and see where it went next, because I really liked the characters. I was really invested in their relationship. So yeah, it was a really fantastic film.
And did you enjoy watching it with an audience in a cinema rather than at home on Netflix?
Yeah, definitely enjoyed watching it in the cinema. I mean, we had a really great crowd in that cinema. It was fully packed, and there were some big laughers. So that really carries it. When there's other people laughing, then you can kind of release and laugh with them. So the comedy bits land a lot better as well. So I think there was a couple of things. If I was watching that at home on my own on Netflix, I don't think some of the jokes would have hit me as well as they did watching with an audience.
And finally, why should people see Hitman on any screen, big or small?
Why should people see Hitman? Do you know what? It's a really fun film, but it's also a really sexy film. And it really reminds me of a lot of films that they don't make anymore. And I think some of the things about this affair going on. Films, I think modern films are quite scared to do that. So to sit in it and sit in this love that's blossoming, and yeah, it was really fun to watch, really exciting. So and I really empathize with the characters, and I think it's something that, you know, well, once the film starts, if you watch it on Netflix at home, you can hit pause and you can get distracted by things. But to sit in it in the cinema and just be along for the whole ride was, I think, the optimum way to watch it and experience it.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Well, as you can see, I'm no longer at Picture House Central. Everything was in such a rush afterwards. I had to get to the train station to get the last train back home. And in fact, I think it's just about to move off now. But yeah, that was it. And I think a lot of interesting opinions. Everyone seemed to like it. And I think it's obviously a great crowd pleaser that everyone should see. But for now, back to the show.
So, as you can see, a lot of people really enjoyed Hitman. Hopefully they thought some of the same things as well. And yeah, I think that really kind of comes down to how much this film really is a massive crowd pleaser. And
I mean, that was very apparent in the screening that we attended at the press show at London Film Festival.
Yeah, we should really talk about that, because this was a film when it started. I mean, people were already excited for it because they already heard the great press that came out of Venice Film Festival, where it debuted. And when it was showing us the press screenings for London Film Festival, it was one of the busiest lines I'd seen yet. It was like going around the block of the BFI South Bank, and it was crazy. I mean, the auditorium itself, NFT1, is quite large, but it was absolutely packed with people who were genuinely excited to see this. And
it was at least three quarters full.
It was at least, yeah. And for a lot of people, it did not disappoint, because as pretty much as soon as it starts, like, people are just laughing and just really getting into it. They're just, there's the moment where, you know, like I said, the ex-wife drops the fact that he wasn't exactly good in bed, and that was met with like a gaudible ooh. It's like a sitcom audience all of a sudden, and it made the experience so much better. And there's a lot of they were really into it. And the scene, one scene in particular, again, don't want to get into spoilers because it happens quite later on, but there is a scene that involves a lot of projection, I guess. there's a lot of stuff that's unsaid, and it's how they kind of work around certain things and how certain things come out. But when that scene ended, the entire auditorium burst into applause.
And this was a press show.
This was a press show. This rarely happens. Aside from something like Godzilla X Kong or something, this does not happen at a press showing at a major film festival. It was odd. Like, all the other ones that either of us were at, they didn't not have as much audience reaction like that. It was astounding.
The scene you're talking about, and I'm being very careful with it because it's such a pivotal scene in the movie, but it requires that kind of juggling of so many different things. Like, he's juggling different identities and different personas in that moment, and the way he's kind of navigating through that situation, it's so beautifully played. Because on the one hand, you've got the tension of the plot in that moment of what's actually happening, but you've also got this kind of comic tension because of the fact that he's working his way through this situation, and the two kind of intertwine beautifully in this kind of, it becomes a dance to itself in a sort of way. And it's, as I said, Linklater very carefully choreographed the sequence. He said that he worked on it for ages and ages and ages, rehearsed it over and over again until it worked. You can clearly tell that in the movie just because it is so just well designed in its execution. You just can't help but applaud. You just can't help but stand up and sort of cheer for what's happening on screen.
Yeah, because by that point, you're so invested in these characters and their relationship with one another that, you know, you really do want them to end up being all right in the end. And it's like I said, it's such a beautifully done moment. I mean, there was one moment, I think Adria Arjona, she kind of like says something about someone, and Gary has this great little reaction, like it's like a little smirk, like a self-satisfied smirk, but you just kind of got to keep it together. That moment was absolutely beautiful, and it brought the house down. Like, again, just how Glenn Powell is so in control of that scene, even when it's kind of played for kind of almost screwball laughs. And it's such a beautifully timed moment, and I'm really hoping that people do get to have that experience when they see it. But unfortunately, the vast majority of people, even those listening right now, the only way they will see it is on Netflix. Because as soon as it debuted, I believe at Toronto, Netflix bagged it for like $20 million for a distribution deal. And
yeah, that's huge.
It was the biggest, not only of that festival, but just the entire festival, yet even that year. This was a massive gain for Netflix. And I remember when that news broke, and a lot of fellow critics and stuff, the overall sense I got was dismay. Because, I mean, as we all know, Netflix has a history of having a very streaming-based distribution style. Most of their stuff goes onto their service, but for some of the bigger titles, like some of their like Oscar contenders or like other big blockbuster ones, they only get a very limited theatrical run, like only like a week or two up to the streaming release. And I feel a lot of people reacted quite negatively to the news that Netflix had picked up Hitman, because like you said, this is a film that deserves to be seen with the crowd. In fact, we experienced this for ourselves at that showing. It's a proven crowd pleaser, and the fact that crowds won't actually get to see it's quite upsetting, honestly, because it's a film that deserves its time on the big screen more than some of the actual films that get cinema releases.
I feel very split about Netflix in terms of, in the one hand, because Netflix has managed to carve out this niche for themselves as being this streamer. You know, people, when they think of streaming, they think of Netflix. So in that way, you know, a lot of people have Netflix, and a movie that is on Netflix is guaranteed to be seen almost certainly, especially if it's one of their bigger titles. It is definitely something that people will get round to seeing. And I think we are seeing that to a certain extent, where movies might not have this huge life theatrically, but they find their proper life on streaming. I mean, we mentioned something like Saltburn or Challengers. MGM did a very conventional theatrical campaign for those movies, but I'd imagine they have found their audiences on Prime Video. The problem is, though, that at least those movies actually had a chance in theatres. At least they might not have found their audience immediately, but I think certainly the theatrical campaigns definitely aided in those movies finding the audience online. They helped build a lot of anticipation, because we also have to understand that, you know, cinema can be quite expensive depending on where you live. So I can understand why people are a bit choosy on what they decide to go and see. But even so, the fact is, we were both in a screening where Hitman went down like absolute gangbusters. Like, everyone in the screening immediately went, that film should be playing to a massive crowd, and it should be something that finds an audience. And I'm certain it would find an audience, because Anyone But You, the other Glenn Powell movie, did fantastically theatrically, and it... And that was where Sony decided to put it in cinemas at Christmas and then just let it run. Just let it run. And I think it found its audience naturally that way. And the problem is, Hitman won't, because even though it is getting a theatrical run, you and I both know how Netflix are going to distribute it. They're going to put it in about 10 sites that, you know, in major cities. You know, loads and loads of screens won't get it at all. It'll be in a couple of slots, and it'll be quite hard to see, and then they'll drop it on Netflix. You know, that's going to be how it rolls, unfortunately.
No, I think you're absolutely on the money, and I mean, some Netflix titles, I mean, yeah, sure, I mean, the ones that get shown on the big screen, yeah, sure, some of them aren't exactly like the deserving of the big screen experience, but films like Hitman are, and I think it's very upsetting that, you know, Netflix isn't willing to work with exhibitors with giving their films that much larger platform. I mean, they made a half-hearted attempt with Glass Onion a couple of years ago. They only put it in cinemas for 1 week only, and then it was gone for a month before it then ended up on Netflix around Christmas. And then they didn't even report any box office numbers or anything. They didn't really give a gauge of how much this was a hit. I saw it in the cinema when it was in that 1 week run, and the thing was packed. It was really, a lot of people had really gone out of their way to actually go and see something like that. And
I mean, it didn't play in my area. In my area, has three cinemas in it. If I had to go and see Glass Onion in a screening, although I did do, I went to the Bristol Watershed to see it when it was in its London Film Festival run. But if I saw it in its like actual Netflix release, I'd have to take a train to bloomin' Hemel Hempstead.
or in my case, you know, go up straight to one of the Curzons in London, you know, or even a Showcase or something nearby. The point is, they're not making it very accessible.
And I feel like that's the entire point. I feel like Netflix, you know, with Glass Onion, they betrayed the entire, like, strategy on their part, in that the release of the movie in cinemas was just basically there as an advert for Netflix, and they had no real interest in it. And you know, they didn't really promote it as much as they probably would have done as a proper theatrical release. So they deliberately restricted the release, didn't report on it, and then when cinema owners asked, oh, can we extend the run because this is making a lot of money for us, they said no. And this is the thing that gets me with Netflix, is that there's a lot of stuff that Netflix makes as originals, or that they've cultivated as niches on their platform. Like rom-coms, for example, have largely disappeared from cinemas over the last couple of years, but the genre has been very much alive on Netflix. And what Netflix, I feel, has cultivated, and what they're very canny at doing at film festivals, is taking these crowd pleasers and sticking them on the platform. And then say, this is where those movies deserve to be. This is where films should be released. And I don't agree with that. But of course, that's all part of their business model. They need to make it streaming focused because that's their whole identity. Because Netflix is you know, is a disruptor. Its existence is to kind of undermine theatrical to a certain extent and say, you don't have to go out to a cinema to see a movie, just stay at home. And so in that way, I do think that, you know, having something like Hitman, which generated a huge amount of buzz in its festival run, that takes away something that cinemas could have had, because that means that it's taken away the audience that would have gone and seen it in a cinema and, you know, bought concessions and all that stuff that's very important to, you know, the day-to-day running of stuff. And so, as a result, you know, I do kind of feel like Netflix is at times a little bit of a hostile entity. Like, they're great for some stuff, but then I feel like their overall ethos is, I don't really agree with it.
I don't think it's just Netflix, though. I think the overall attitude in a lot of Hollywood studios right now is to give their films like a theatrical release as normal, but then only a few weeks after it's released, they put it on digital to rent or buy. And it's creating this kind of really eerie mentality that, you know, oh, you don't need to go to the cinema to see something like Abigail because it'll be on digital in a couple of weeks. It's just like, save your money or what.
Yeah.
It's just like, first of all, doing that to something like a very, very small film, that one that didn't exactly like make a lot of money or whatever. I mean, that's one thing. But when it's like a film that has proven to be like a critical hit, people do enjoy seeing it. A film like Abigail, again, that's a film I think definitely deserves its time on the big screen. It's a fun kind of throwback horror comedy with great actors and a lot of violence and stuff. That's the sort of stuff that should be playing. But then just putting it on places like Amazon and Rakuten, SkyStore, all of these digital markets, it really undermines that theatrical experience. And I think there's a certain irony, you know, Netflix being this disruptor, you know, when they're releasing a film like Glass Onion, which is all about how disruptors aren't really disruptors, they're just arseholes. And, and I feel that there's a very... That seems to be a depressing reluctance for both streamers and exhibitors to really come together and make it work. Like, I look to something like Mubi as a very good example of it. They have their own distribution platform and they give their films like a decent enough theatrical release, like more than a couple of weeks at the very least. And people do see them, albeit they're not as widely shown as like some of the other films are, but they are at least given that platform. And again, like you mentioned with Challengers and Saltburn, with MGM and before they went on Prime Video, and Netflix, I feel, really needs to step up its game when it comes to theatrical distribution, because that's the way that films will really survive, in my opinion. I think that just dumping it onto a streaming service in an endless pit of so many other films that people don't even remember, and it's not going to help it in terms of longevity. I think it's going to really kind of sweep films like Hitman under the rug, and that does not fit a film that is so smart and is so funny and great chemistry all around. I feel like a film like that just being swept under all this other content, as in this term, I don't like to call it that, but that's what it is to them. It's content. And it's just too much. And I think it's going to really bite them in the arse, because people are starting to realize, again, Anyone But You, that could have easily gone to Netflix. But no, they played the long game. They made sure that people saw it. They even gave it a re-release around Valentine's Day to really capitalize on the fact that people were going to see this.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that it's a real shame that there are places like Netflix that don't offer that same courtesy to their films. Because if they're so into like spending millions of dollars on films that people don't even remember. Like, I don't even remember what happened in The Gray Man or Red Notice or anything like that. Those films have like millions of dollars to their name, and they're just wasteful. I think it's a very wasteful thing for Netflix to just kind of dump their stuff on the platform without giving anyone the opportunity to actually go and see it.
I think it's a multi-tiered problem, in that I think it creates this kind of disposable kind of mentality, both in terms of how the audience consumes things and how the company views their own product. But I think also in terms of the way that audiences perceive things. Like, I see a lot of talk about, oh, well, this needs to be a big movie to make me go out into the cinema. And I go, actually, I don't like that mindset, because then you just get blockbuster after blockbuster after blockbuster. It becomes very samey and monotonous. And the great thing about cinema is that when you're in the right audience, you know, you have that shared connection. And it doesn't necessarily have to be like huge world-ending stakes. It doesn't have to be the biggest movie of the week. sometimes it's about the way that a movie can connect with people. And Hitman's a great example of this. You know, we're having this kind of shared communal experience. And I feel like that's important to have in our communities. Cinemas are part of communities. They're places for, you know, people to relax and kind of, you know, take 2 hours away. Those places are important. So that's why I fight for having cinemas, and not to mention, you know, jobs and things like that. They are important to have. If you get rid of them, you will miss them. They need to be protected to a certain extent. And I also think, in terms of the way that films are released, we don't give films enough room to actually find their audiences. And back in the day, movies would play for, you know, weeks on end. Now, if it flops in the first week, goodbye. And I think that's a really shitty way of doing things, because, you know, not everyone can make it to see the film in the first week. Not everyone can rush out or hears about the film. I mean, film marketing as well, you know, you hear so often people like aren't even aware of stuff being released. It's so challenging. And I feel like we need to have a huge discussion and a huge shift on the way that we distribute things, the way that we kind of market things. And also, yeah, maybe we need to move away from the pandemic model of releasing things 3 weeks after we release them theatrically. You know, we're kind of moving away from that now, and yet we've still got this relic of that era. And I feel like, who is doing this? Who is literally paying £15 to watch a movie that they could go and see at the cinema for, what, half the price? If you're like a view, you could go and see a movie for a fiver. Like, what are we doing? What are we doing?
I feel like, you know, 4 years after a global pandemic, I think that's enough time for big studios and stuff to realize that, you know, people don't want this anymore. I mean, audience tastes can be fickle anyway. And I think obviously during the pandemic, you know, cinemas were closed, and that's one thing, but it's 4 years later and it's just like, move on, you know, like give
yeah,
it.
Yeah, exactly.
It's proving to be a very destructive kind of thing for exhibitors and, you know, just audience tastes. Like, I mean, you see it all the time now. Like, The Fall Guy just debuted kind of an underwhelming box office on its opening weekend, and both of us really liked it, and a lot of audiences did too, but they're already writing it off as a failure when it's not even had a chance to even be the kind of sleeper hit that anyone but you was. Like, I mean, I don't always, like, judge a film's box office performance on the first weekend. It's all, you always got to watch out for, like, how much it drops in the second weekend or how much it holds. Sure. You know, like, that's the real sign of when a film is actually finding an audience or not. Because I remember when Batman v Superman came out, the first opening weekend was, like, 160-something. It was massive. But then you look at the second weekend and there's like a 60, 50, yeah, absolute drop.
Yeah, like it had no competition in its second weekend. What was it? God's Not Dead 2. And like, it's still tanked. And that's entirely due to word of mouth. You know, you can open a movie massively, but if people don't like it, you know, it's going to drop like a stone.
Absolutely. And people responded to stuff like Anyone But You, because, you know, I personally don't think it was a great film, but it was fun, you know, like, it was...
Yeah, it was entertaining enough.
Yeah, it was entertaining. It's entertaining modern take on Much Ado About Nothing with two very popular actors. You know, I can definitely see this thing having legs, and it did. I don't know, it's such a weird time for distribution right now, but I think, ultimately, after all that, regardless how you watch it, whether it's in one of the few cinema screenings or if it is on Netflix, I do think that people should still see this film, because I mean, it's a real crowd pleaser. It's going to put you in such a good mood, and it's funny, it's dark, it's got so much going for it, and it's romantic as well. It's one of those things, like The Fall Guy, to use the old cliche, it's got something for everyone.
It really does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
We were talking about the way that it blends various things together, and as Richard Linklater said that he wanted a kind of screwball element to the movie. I think you can see that. You know, Glenn Powell, he has the charm of someone like Cary Grant, and, you know, it's funny that we talk about Cary Grant, because Cary Grant himself was a persona, a creation, as we understand.
Yeah, so, it wasn't even his real name.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, you think of Cary Grant, you think, you know, the intelligence and the wit, you see that in something like like Hitman, but also you got kind of elements of sort of Coen Brothers in there as well. And, you know, you got the rom-com elements. Like, you've got all of this mixed together into something that is very, very satisfying. And regardless of where anyone sees it, I just hope they see it. And I hope it finds an audience that understands that this is a really special, really brilliant movie. And I think it's probably some of Linklater's best work in quite a few years.
Oh, yeah. Like, this is, like, this is probably his best film since Boyhood, honestly, which yeah. is just, is pretty much his masterpiece. And this one is damn, damn good. Like, it's definitely, you were saying as well, like, I think in your podcast, it's giving off School of Rock vibes. And I love yeah. School of Rock. And, like, I know a lot of people do too. And it's definitely that kind of vibe. And I think people will really respond to that if they just go see it. So anyone who out there who's watching or listening, please, for the love of God, see Hitman. I don't care how you see it. It's in cinemas or on Netflix. Just see it, because that's how we grow as a society. My God.
I'm going to go one further than that. If you're interested in a movie and you think, oh, that kind of, you know, speaks to me a little bit, go out and see it theatrically. Support cinemas. Go out and see them. If you're in a position to do that, and I know that not everyone is, but if you can, it really does matter, because, you know, I feel like now especially theatrical is where the votes are cast. Those are the movies that are going to get made over and over again. So you need to support, you know, if I want to see more things like that, you have to see them theatrically, because that is where the decisions are being made. Once it comes onto streaming, it's too late, because the narrative has already been written. It's a failure. It doesn't have a life. And I don't think that's true either. There's a lot of movies that had a second life on cable, on television. We're seeing it on streaming. But even so, I think that it's very important that movies find their audiences, and also that audiences come to the movies, not wait for the movie to come to them.
That's a pretty good way to put it. I couldn't have put it better myself. So if you can see it theatrically, please do. I think that's a pretty damn good place to end this conversation. So, yeah, Matthew.
I'm going to get off the soapbox.
No, it's a good soapbox again. Oh, well, this has been really fun. I really enjoy talking with you, Matt, and thank you so much for coming on. And where can all the wonderful people listening or watching find you on social media?
You can find me on YouTube at Filmbrain. Just go to youtube.com/Filmbrain. You'll go right to my channel. I've got a Twitter, got a Facebook. I'm on pretty much all the social media platforms, but I'm not going to list them all here. I'm just going to say, go Linktree Filmbrain. You'll find all the various avenues and ways to support me. What every little bit helps. It's really appreciated, and thank you for having me on, Jack. It really has been a pleasure.
Yeah, well, absolutely, and obviously hope to have you back in the future. But thank you very much, everyone. I'll see you next time.
Take care, everyone.
Hey, you've made it to the end of the episode. Thank you so much for sticking around. Please like and subscribe on whichever platform you may be listening on. Make sure that you're following Film Feeder on all our social media channels, the links and handles to which are all listed in the episode description. And do consider becoming a paid patron at patreon.com/filmfeeder for as little as $4 a month. Finally, don't forget to visit the Film Feeder website at filmfeeder.co.uk, where every week I post written reviews and handy movie menu roundups of all the newest releases coming to cinemas, streaming, and on demand here in the UK. Until next time, I'm Jack Martin, your film chef extraordinaire, whetting your appetite for film each and every month. Bye for now.